Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of a bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. You have me and I'm flying solo today because they're all doing other things. And I decided I want to go and do something on the War of the Roses. I haven't done a podcast like this in a while. So with me, I have Daniel Burton, who's a historian who specialises in the War of the Roses, amongst other things as well, which she underlined to me earlier, as well as the life of Anthony Woodville. And this is what her first book is actually on, Anthony Woodville's Sophisticate or Schema, which is all about the War of the, well, partially about the War of the Roses. Hi, Danielle. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, great to be here.
Really excited because I haven't done one of these in a while. Let's talk about your book because I guess when we talk about the Woodvilles, especially in popular history, we tend to talk about them in snippets. And we don't tend to talk about Anthony Woodville himself. I mean, I know very little about him. So I'm really interested in knowing more about who he was. So before we jump into who he is, who are the Woodvilles?
Yeah, so I suppose we kind of hear him from the Woodvilles in terms of, you know, his Anthony's sister Elizabeth marries Edward IV, and that's really the main way that people know who the Woodvilles are, that they've at least heard of his sister Elizabeth Woodville. So really, she kicked everything off really by marrying King Edward IV, which was seen to be quite a big thing because the Woodvilles were actually a lower gentry family. So obviously somebody from that kind of background marrying the king in those days, you know, really, a big thing not to do, really. So that's kind of where they come from, really, that their main lands are in Northamptonshire, but they do own lands in other counties. But that's kind of where they are, really, that they were known on a local level, really. They had a lot of local, you know, county jobs, those sorts of things, you know, that would have made them important in the counties that they owned land, but not necessarily, you know, on the countrywide scale. So they weren't, you know, nobodies, but, you know, compared to obviously, you know, the royal family and all of the nobility, they're not quite the people that you'd expect to be marrying into royalty, really. But actually, I think where I start my book with is with Anthony's grandfather, who was called Richard Woodville, because he's the one that kind of starts getting the Woodville name a little bit higher up the scale, really. So he becomes involved in the Hundred Years' War with quite like a lot of people at that time. So he ends up actually working his way through that and promoting himself to Esquire of the Body to Henry V. And that's kind of slowly where you start to see the Woodvilles are involved in a few more things. And then obviously Anthony's father, who was also called Richard Woodville, as they all like to name themselves after each other in this period. So within, you know, he's the one that kind of gets more involved again because he's actually, you know, the family started to find favour, like I said, with the royalty at that point. But it's Richard Woodville that people mainly know is the first one who did because he was actually employed in the household of the Duke of Bedford, who was the regent of France when Henry VI was a very young child at that point. So that's kind of where you start to see them emerging a little bit more.
Out of curiosity, slightly off topic, well, not really, because you kind of brought it up a little bit, was this idea that Elizabeth marries above her and Edward obviously marries beneath him. Obviously, we have all seen the TV program. What is it? The
White Queen.
That's it. The White Queen.
Yeah.
Now, out of curiosity with that, obviously you see it because she charms him with magic. We all know that's bullshit, right? First of all, because that is how you're going to basically portray women, and that's how a lower class woman married a higher class man. Do we actually know how they met?
Actually, a lot of that kind of courtship is very much quite, you know, kept quite quiet, because obviously at that point Edward is being there's marriage negotiations that the Earl of Warwick is the head of, to hopefully marry him to possibly a French princess. So that's quite at an advanced stage. So, like I said, there's lots of smoke and mirrors, really, in that sense, that we don't really know when and where and whatnot. It's just that how many months after their marriage, Edward kind of goes, "Hey, by the way, I'm married to Elizabeth Woodville." So it's one of those cases of, you know, it's not really brought up straight away. So we're never going to know 100% the details, sadly.
So that's why it was invented, to do with the magic and kind of smoke and mirror.
Yeah, but it also comes from the fact that much later down the line, the Earl of Warwick is trying to get rid of the Woodville camp around Edward the Fourth, because he's the guy that he's called the Kingmaker. He's the guy who helped Edward become king, and he doesn't like the fact that there's other people muscling in on his space, really. So later on, he actually invents a witchcraft case against Chiquetta Woodville, Antonine Elizabeth's mother, and it actually does go to court, and he brings what's used as evidence is these little magic figures that mysteriously appeared and nobody really knew where from, and he says that they were used as like voodoo dolls, I suppose is what we probably describe them as, to suggest that that was how Elizabeth and Edward, you know, fell in love and got married.
Right, so let's come back to Anthony. Obviously, me going off on a tangent is expected. But let's talk about his family life, because we are obviously going to jump into things like fighting, chivalry, politics and all that, because you cannot talk about this story or about that without those things. But what does it tell us about him as a person if we look at him and his family life?
Well, I suppose in terms of the fact that we all know that the Woodvilles were quite a large family. So obviously that brings implications, like I've already slightly alluded to, that means that they are quite a large group now forming around King Edward the Fourth that would not necessarily have possibly got so high up the chain as they would have done without, you know, Elizabeth and Edward's marriage. So really, actually, they were quite, considering that there's quite a large family, they're actually quite a close-knit family as well. I think we kind of sometimes fall into the trap that people in the past don't necessarily have the emotions that we have now. And you kind of think, oh, it was all politics, you know, family was all about politics at that time, which of course it, you know, for people of a certain status, it was. You know, following Elizabeth's marriage, it's very much been a case of, oh, she's been accused of trying to promote her family through marriage. But actually, Anthony Woodville himself was actually one of the ones who had actually married prior to Elizabeth's own marriage to Edward the Fourth. So actually, he's not part of that particular bit. He'd found the person that he wanted to marry before, just before they got married. We think, again, not really sure at this time, you know, there's lots of dates that don't necessarily get recorded. So we think that Anthony Woodville married his first wife, Elizabeth Scales, in the run-up to the Battle of Towton in 1461. So we kind of, in that respect, I think he's very much, what, you know, he's, you know, in these days, family is pretty much everything, really, and its status and its relationships that matter and things like that. But actually, he's also trying to carve a way for himself as well, just like any, you know, anybody today would probably understand that, really. But actually, even though there is that closeness, I think very much he was not necessarily wanting to be involved in the politics and all of the, you know, all of that, that perhaps other members of his family have become much more well known for. So I think in that respect, in my personal opinion, I kind of imagine him as, right, yeah, I'm a guy, I love my family. And he did. He was completely family orientated. But I kind of feel like he would be very good at constructive criticism as to what they might be doing wrong. Kind of, you know, that father, uncle figure of the family, really, which is what he ended up being later on. But for me, I think the most important thing to note in terms of relationships with his family is he lost a lot of family members through quite difficult circumstances. So, for example, his father Richard and his brother John, they were executed without trial after the Battle of Edgecote. So we can only imagine what that would have done to the family as a whole. But in a way, Anthony never really forgot that, because he actually ended up giving land to the College of Eton, which was actually a personal connection to his brother John, that he gave it in honour of his brother John. So I think that shows that even though he's staying out of things, that he's still doing personal things for his family. So there is a sense of loyalty there, even though he does want to carve a different life for himself personally.
I'm just trying to put this family tree in order in my head here. So he is the second son.
No, so Anthony's the first son. There's a bit of argument because they know that they lost one son called Lewis, and there's not actually, because of them being a lower gentry family, there's not really very good records as to birth order particularly. So he's definitely the first surviving son, because there's arguments as to whether or not this Lewis was actually before or after Anthony in birth order. So he's definitely the first son, but there's arguments as to whether or not him or Elizabeth was the first, the firstborn. Because again, like I said, there's at this point, that unless you are probably, you know, high nobility or royalty, it's not very good at keeping dates and things of people's births. So they're actually not too sure when Anthony was born, possibly somewhere between 1440 and 1441.
So either him or, my point is, so he,
yeah,
that was going to be my next question, was Elizabeth older or younger? But if we stick around the same age range, I guess,
yeah,
that's
they
the best
are. There's probably no more than about, you know, anywhere between 3, 4, 5 years. So not too much of an age difference between him and Elizabeth.
Okay, so coming back to Anthony, we have this really nice overview of what he's like, a family orientated man. Like the uncle figure that you said he is going to become. They're now at this point in the Yorkist camp after his father and his brother both get executed. And now he ends up again riding to war, and he ends up in Northumbria. How does that come about?
Yeah, so the Woodvilles become Yorkist after the Battle of Towton in 1461, which is the battle that made Edward IV king. So at that point, their family decides, you know, Edward's now king, let's stick to being Yorkist. So what happens then is, obviously, even though the Lancastrians are defeated, you have particularly Queen Margaret of Anjou, who's the wife of Henry VI, particularly wanting to fight, not necessarily for her husband, because I think she probably understands that he's a bit of a contentious figure, as he's, you know, was king from a baby and has quite a lot of mental illnesses. It's not, even if it might be for, in the name of Henry, that she's fighting for her son, who's obviously going to be the heir. So she carries on fighting, really, even if necessarily, like I said, Henry VI isn't necessarily capable of doing that. She's the one who organises armies to come back and fight for the Lancastrians. So what happened is that she was able to get a lot of support from France, because she was originally from France herself, and also Scotland, because they do kind of have a sort of alliance with France, and also they like causing trouble in England. So she gets support that way, and obviously Northumberland's fairly close to the Scottish border, so that's where these forces kind of land and, you know, accumulate in this, you know, in the Lancashire name. So Edward, you know, he's only been a king for a year and a bit, So he has to go out and fight for this because he realises how, at this point, how brittle his reign is, because he's obviously not been king for very long, and obviously you still have got this Lancastrian threat. So he rides out of London in late 1462 with an army. And it's been described as possibly the biggest group of noble peers at that time. You know, so it's quite a substantial number that he's marching up towards Northumberland with. So, and Anthony is actually one of those men in this force. So it's actually the first time since the family turned Yorkist that he has got the chance to prove his newfound loyalty and, you know, say, look, I can do this, really. So that all seems to be going swimmingly until Edward actually catches measles and he has to stay in Durham. So the Earl of Warwick has to be then the guy in charge of all of this force, and he takes them to Northumberland. But obviously, unfortunately, the time of year, they decide that they're going to besiege all of these castles in Northumberland in November, December, January. So there was a lot of really bad winter weather, which, you know, hindered that, really. And obviously with the sudden change of leadership as well, there was quite a few things not working necessarily to the Yorkist advantage. But Anthony was actually at the Siege of Alnwick, which was the last of the Northumberland castles to fall with these sieges. So actually that was probably the most brutal because of it being the longest. So there was this stories of, you know, morale being really low because they're having to sit there all the time, you know, besieging this castle in, you know, very cold, wintry conditions. Not necessarily the greatest thing to be doing. So, and again, like I said, as it was the last one to fall, that a lot of, there was quite a large group of Scotsmen actually came to relieve the siege, and they actually managed to rescue quite a number out of Lancashians from inside the castle. So that's kind of what brought the siege to an end, really, rather than any fierce fighting necessarily. But actually, even though it kind of did go badly wrong and was kind of criticised in terms of not really planning about weather or leadership necessarily, for Anthony himself, it had been that opportunity that he needed to prove himself to the Yorkist regime, really. And not long after, he actually was awarded the Order of the Garter, which is something that you have to be, you have to have a recommendation from somebody to be able to gain, you know, the Order of the Garter. And that's by either, you know, proving yourself militarily, as well as proving that you have good enough family connections as well.
So far, we've seen that he's a good soldier. He gets a prestigious award. But apparently, he also, how would you say this? He also fights in tournaments.
Yes.
Is he good at it?
Yes, actually. So it turns out that it's a skill that the Woodville men kind of all share, actually. So his father, Richard, and two of his brothers, John and Edward, are all very good jousting champions, really. And Anthony is part of that. And I suppose he's actually the most famous of his brothers in terms of, you know, tournaments, really. But his most famous one was actually the Smithfield tournament in London. And that was part of the idea of trying to gain better connections and alliances with Burgundy. So he actually fought that with a guy also called Antoine. I'll say Antoine to not confuse him with Anthony, who was known as the Bastard of Burgundy. He was actually the illegitimate son of Philip, the Duke of Burgundy. So this whole tournament had been organised as part of attempts to gain this alliance. So it all starts off with Margaret of York, who is Edward IV's youngest sister, being betrothed to Philip, the Duke of Burgundy's heir. And this is all tied in with that, a way of finding diplomatic ways of, you know, cementing this alliance. So, you know, what better way in the age of chivalry to have a tournament as well, with because Antoine was meant to be a very famous Burgundian tournament champion as well. So it's basically pitting off. I suppose if you came up with two really famous footballers today, it's the equivalent of that, basically.
A football off.
Yes. Like somebody's dream team kind of idea. The same sort of idea, really, I think. Because really, tournaments, I kind of see them as like the big football matches of their day, really, in terms of, you know, the amount of people that would have been going to see these spectacles. So his most famous one is this one that he fought at Smithfield. And you think, great, you know, you can immediately see how big and how grand that this is going to be, is because they are allowed to, you know, it's written in the rules that they're allowed to bring spare horses if, you know, in case there's any accidents or whatever. And Anthony alone bought 9 horses with him, and they were all completely caparisoned up, so all dressed in spectacular things. And, you know, and they all had each of the, you know, they'd have had people bringing in all of their equipment. So he had like the Duke of Clarence carrying, you know, helmets and all things, like, you know, all of the gear that they'd need for this. It's one massive spectacle, really, as well as about, you know, using your military skills for practice, really. So it's two things at once, that you're basically looking fabulous and you're also trying to kick the crap out of each other. It's one of those, you know, as you do.
I think the only time I remember seeing anything like that on TV was Please Do Not Judge Me, is A Knight's Tale with...
No, I do not judge you, because funnily enough, when I've organised my PowerPoints for talks, I've actually got a clip of that, because actually, even though, as most people probably guess, it's not necessarily a historically accurate film, because it's not trying to be, but actually the jousting setup is 100% accurate.
Oh,
that's
really?
Pretty much how it would be set up, in terms of you would have similar things like a bandstand kind of, you know, tiered seating for the rich people, you know, and you'd have all of that kind of thing going on, but you'd also just have, you know, you'd be paying, people would be paying to just stand up and watch this. So actually, Knight's Tale's view of it is quite good, I think.
I'm going to have to go back and rewatch it tonight. That's what I'm going to do. Thank you
yeah.
for that. You mentioned Burgundy. Is that what his links are to the region through this specific match?
And so that's one of the links, because, as I said, the guy that he's fighting is the illegitimate son of the Duke of Burgundy. He actually was, him and his father, Richard, were put on in charge of the marriage negotiations for Margaret of York to Charles the Bold, which kind of, like I said, the tournament was an offshoot, because the tournament was organised 2 years before when the marriage negotiations were going off. But Antoine, the Bastard of Burgundy, was actually busy fighting elsewhere, so they'd had to wait 2 years until his schedule had cleared up.
Hold on. Did you just say, I'm sorry, I'm busy fighting, put my marriage on hold?
Not the marriage itself. It was like just the tournament that was fought on behalf of England and Burgundy.
Oh, that makes more sense. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry. I've completely cut you off there. What were the rest of the list?
All right. Yeah, so that's the main one. So obviously at that point, like I said, he's organised the marriage between Margaret of York and Charles the Bold, which had already happened by the time of the tournament. But that's only one small part of it, really. So obviously he's had to travel out there and be a diplomat, and he would have had to have been very good at languages to be able to do that as well. But at this point, a lot of Europe, the courts of Europe and everything, spoke a lot of French. So obviously, you know, that's the main language that people are using, rather than their, you know, the basic languages when they're, you know, doing diplomatic things. So he goes over and does that, you know, organises that, and obviously that's successful, as, you know, Margaret and Charles do get married. But when Edward IV is exiled, when Henry VI briefly comes back to the throne in 1470, Anthony goes out, is one of the group that goes out with Edward into exile, including Richard, Duke of Gloucester, and some others close circle of Edward IV. So he actually goes into exile in Burgundy as well. So that's another big connection, as they end up, they first, because they all went in different ships to start off with, so they all ended up being blown across different places, but they all ended up being staying in Burgundy, because obviously they built up this alliance through the Yorkist marriage, that means that they have got a safe space to live whilst they're in exile, and they all end up staying with a guy called Louis, the Lord of Gruthuse, who is kind of, I suppose, he's kind of a representative of the Duke in, you know, in the areas that he lives. So he goes and lives, they all go and live with him in Bruges. And he was actually famous for possibly having Europe's biggest library at that point. So, considering this is a point where majority of books are still being produced through illuminated manuscripts, as you're only just starting to get the printing press coming in, you know, you can just imagine how much money he's ended up paying for the majority of that library. So he is quite an important person, really, and I think probably the right person to have gone to for help, really, at that point. So it's either through the marriage of Margaret of Burgundy to Charles the Bold, because Anthony did go out with the marriage. He was the head of the marriage party, so he was there making sure that Margaret got to Burgundy okay, got married, you know, all done, sealed, all that stuff. So it's either during that journey or when they're in exile that we think that he's also become friendly with William Caxton, who was the printer who bought the printing press to England in the first place, because around this point, just before he becomes a printer, so at the time of Margaret's marriage to Charles the Bold, that's when he was actually an English merchant out in Burgundy. So he was actually the head of the merchant community in Bruges. So there's one or other of those instances is probably how Anthony Woodville and William Caxton met as well. So there's lots of little tidbits going off between him and Burgundy, really.
You've mentioned already this, that he was a man that had to know languages. He was well educated. So he's not just a soldier, but he is I'm trying to find the right way of saying this. He's much more than just a man on a horse or a man with a sword. He's also a man of.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Letters, isn't he?
Yes, he is. So as I slightly mentioned there, is the other way that people might have heard of Anthony Woodville is the fact that he was William Caxton's first English patron. So William Caxton, like I said, he was an English merchant out in Burgundy. He'd kind of seen that's Europe is starting to adopt the printing press as a new invention. That doesn't mean that illuminated manuscripts go out of fashion instantly. They actually ended up at this point working alongside each other. And William Caxton was like, right, I'm getting in on this, and went and trained to be, you know, working the printing press. And he actually did that in Burgundy for a bit, under the patronage of Margaret of Burgundy. But at some point, he became involved with Anthony Woodville, and we think it's that relationship that brought William Caxton to bringing his printing press and his printing shops to Westminster. And Anthony Woodville actually was not just his patron. He actually helped him to translate texts, because that's what Caxton was quite famous for. Was not only was he printing texts, he actually was, because obviously at this point, I'd say it's the start of the Renaissance, because you start to get the idea of texts and other things being translated into everybody's, you know, into English, French, or, you know, whatever kind of or language that you want, rather than either the Latin or the Greek, which is what kind of went before, really. And Anthony's quite a large part in that, as in we know that he translated at least three, maybe four texts for William Caxton, and then Caxton then went on to produce them. And the main one that everybody kind of sort of knows is called The Dixon Sayings of the Philosophers. So it's basically, so it's translated from a French text that he was actually given whilst he was on pilgrimage in Spain. And it's basically just sayings and repetitions and all sorts of moral things that were created by the ancient philosophers, particularly, you know, Aristotle, Socrates, things like that. So that's the main one that people kind of might be aware of, as that's actually the first printed book that was printed in England with a definite date and place of publication. So it's quite important, really. And it's also the illuminated manuscript version. It's the only contemporary image that we actually have of Anthony Woodville. He's portrayed handing this book over to Edward IV in the illuminated version as well.
I love this. He's actually a very influential person, and I don't know why we don't know more about him.
This is it, because like I said, I think it's mainly that people have gone, well, he's not, whilst he is kind of, you know, a military man as well, he's not kind of like Edward IV and it's only the military stuff that he's interested in, sort of thing. So actually, he's more in the background stuff, but in that respect, actually, he's more important, because he's actually helping to shape the culture that we now very much associate with this late 15th, early 16th century, you know, in terms of what's that's doing to, you know, bringing the printing press over, and kind of, he's really kind of thinking, right, what is it that we need to kind of, I think, I've heard it said before that Edward IV was trying to create a replica of Arthur, you know, Arthur's Camelot. And I kind of think, well, actually, if you think about what on earth is Arthur's Camelot, whilst of course there is military side of it, and, you know, in the Knights of the Round Table, you also think like of people like Merlin and then everybody who are kind of shaping the culture behind it. So I think in that respect, in a way, you could say that Anthony is, you know, he's Edward's Merlin. You know, he's behind the scenes working. Yeah,
I like that. That's actually a really nice analogy. I'm going to use that from now on. Thank you for that. Good. One. But he is also, so let me start that again. So he comes out of exile, obviously, with Edward. And then he is given, well, an important role. Probably this is one of the most important roles for him, isn't it? And that is becoming governor to his nephew, Edward, Prince of Wales.
Yes. So Prince Edward, he was born whilst Edward was out in exile, which is also explains why he's called Edward. And like I said, everybody seems to like naming their children after each other. So that's kind of what's going on, really, that when he does return back from exile, Edward IV, and regains the throne, it's now safe to think, right, okay, have we saved the Yorkist dynasty again? You know, have we saved it for future generations? And obviously now that he has the heir, which he's been waiting quite a while for, but, you know, he's here now. He was born actually in incarceration. You know, Elizabeth Woodville was in Westminster, you know, in sanctuary, and that's where Prince Edward was born. So it's now a case of, right, okay, the throne's hopefully safe. And it pretty much was until Edward died, compared to the first half of his reign that was very much fueled by rebellions. So it's very much about now, okay, we have the heir, we've got to do what we can to secure the Yorkist dynasty for future generations. And obviously they have to think, right, what are we going to do now with this young prince? You know, we've got to turn him into a king. So really the whole point was there was a council to look after him to start off with. That's how it first started to work, with people like Elizabeth Woodville, Richard Duke of Gloucester, Anthony on board, and some other people who are, you know, quite close to the Yorkist regime to make sure everything's going smoothly. And that kind of runs for a good few years until it's decided, okay, he's old enough now, what are you going to start doing? So he's actually moved to Ludlow in Shropshire, which is in the Welsh Marches, to kind of see out his education, I suppose, really. So really, for a young, very young child, that must have been very confusing, really, that he suddenly moved from his family to go and live in the middle of nowhere, really. Although Ludlow was a Yorkist stronghold before, as it came down from Edward's ancestors to him. So it was seen as a safe space to let this young king grow up. And it was basically Anthony's role as governor of the head, you know, the governor or the head of Prince Edward's household, to look after him in every respect, really. So he's kind of given quite a long list of rules by King Edward to say, right, this is what I want to happen. And I find it really quite ironic that a lot of the rules are like, oh yeah, make sure he does his studies, and he's got to still have his exercise, and he's got to be pious, and this, that, and the other. And you're like, I can now see why he kind of wanted somebody else to look after him, because a lot of those things are not things that Edward IV is, if I'm honest. Edward IV is, you know, well known for being an eater, a drinker, and a womaniser. So it's quite obvious that he's really, you know, whilst he was growing up as the son of a duke himself, he would not have necessarily had the education needed for a king.
To be a king, my God, all the formalities and all of this, it's like you're a puppet on a string.
Yes, so that's the whole point of Prince Edward's education, is to kind of fit him up for politics, religion, diplomacy, you know, everything imaginable that a Renaissance king should be. Like we said, that we kind of imagine the whole idea of Renaissance kings and princes being a good mixture of pious, you know, physically able, you know, military skills, you know, as well as being an educated, well-rounded person. And that's kind of the idea of what's going on in Ludlow, that it should be a mixture of all of those things. And actually, the whole idea is perhaps Anthony has been chosen because he's the guy that fits all of those things best, really. I mean, he was close, of course, obviously, to Edward IV as his brother-in-law, but I think Edward kind of mentions, well, he's a right, trustworthy person, you know, as well as being my well-beloved brother-in-law. So it's kind of like, well, actually, we think Anthony's probably the best person to be Prince Edward's role model. And he's the only person that's specifically named in that list of instructions that should pretty much almost always be around the prince. So I think that says a lot, possibly, about what is thought of Anthony's character.
You're giving all of these positive vibes about Anthony, but his ending's not so positive, is it?
No, I'll be honest. No, definitely not.
Let's talk about his fall from grace and what happens to him in the end, because I I'm hyped up with how cool and amazing and smart and how incredibly influential this man is. Yet you're going to ruin it all for me, aren't you?
I wish I didn't have to, I'll be honest.
Go for it, ruin it. Kill the rose-tinted glasses.
Obviously, as I've said, that really not only is he been the main person in Prince Edward's life, he's pretty much the father figure, really, more than Edward the Fourth was, because obviously living in Ludlow, it's kind of a nice little bubble and away from other things. But sadly, in April of 1483, Edward the Fourth died only in his 40s. So that meant that the person who is now king, Prince Edward is of Wales, Prince of Wales, has now become Edward the Fifth at age just 12. And from history, we can kind of see that having a boy king is not a good idea. Of course, there's a lot of friction, a lot of fighting, a lot of wars, and that's basically what started the Wars of the Roses, was the fact that Henry the Sixth had come to the throne as a baby and had been able to be manipulated, and it caused a lot of friction and basically resulted in the Wars of the Roses. So everybody would have been acutely aware of what this meant, because not only have you got, like I said, Henry the Sixth within living memory, you've also got people like Richard the Second, who also came to the throne as a child, didn't really work out. So you've got this struggle of what, how is the country going to be governed under a 12-year-old boy, because he's not quite yet old enough to rule himself, so he is going to need some help. But how are you going to stop people abusing that position? So this is where now 1483, the events of spring 1483, are probably some of the most controversial things of what happened and most contentious as to what actually did and didn't happen. So I'll try and put it as simply as what I think happened during that time. It helped really that obviously Anthony was still at Ludlow. That meant that there was some person of, quite responsible standing with the prince at that point. But you have a Richard, Duke of Gloucester, who is Edward the Fourth's youngest brother. He has been possibly named as the Lord Protector. But there is also discussion at this point, of should it be one person who's in charge, or should there be a council that helps run things behind the scenes whilst the young prince, the young king, is too young to rule in his own right. So there's that all this kind of political discussions going on behind the scenes, but whilst all that's going on, there is a date set for the coronation, and they have to get to London for the date of the coronation. And actually, whilst they found out in Ludlow on the 14th of April, that the young Prince Edward is now king, it takes them until the 24th to actually leave Ludlow. So you can't. There has been a lot of thing of, well, why would it take them so long, et cetera, et cetera. And the main idea that's portrayed is that the 23rd is actually Saint George's Day, and in those days, saint days and were quite a big thing to mark. So it's thought that that they wanted to mark that occasion.
So where does Anthony fall into all of this?
Well, so like I said, the whole point now is you kind of sort of have two camps starting to form. So you have the ones that possibly want to stick with Richard, Duke of Gloucester, and try and promote him as the person to be in charge. Or you have the people that think possibly the Woodvilles as a family want to kind of be the people running the show. And I must admit, I think that Anthony necessarily, because we're all seeing at this point that the Woodvilles are really seriously scheming to get behind the throne. And really, I've not seen any evidence that Anthony was actually a part of that. So I kind of, he actually was also, like I said, he had been in exile with Richard, Duke of Gloucester, when Edward the Fourth Circle were in exile. So they'd actually knew each other and quite well. And only a few months prior to Edward the Fourth's death, Anthony had actually asked Richard to to help him in a legal matter. So I think really he was kind of caught in the middle, really. As in, I think he understood that obviously he's, you know, this nephew, but who is also, you know, part Woodville as well. And that also, you know, well, if Edward IV really did ask for Richard to become Lord Protector, you know, maybe that's a good idea. But by the sounds of it, I think if there had been a council in charge rather than just one single person, that actually Anthony would have been perfectly accepted on that council, because, you know, he's a person that's already been with Prince Edward for pretty much the majority of his life. He's going to be someone that he can trust, somebody that already kind of knows, you know, the systems that had already been in place. So I think really he could have possibly been on a council. So without any problems. But I think in that respect, that's what made him get caught in the middle, because he's kind of between these two camps, really. So what happens is obviously they leave Ludlow, they make their way to London, but it's agreed that they should meet Richard Duke of Gloucester en route. And there's discussions about, okay, right, well, obviously you need an armed guard to look after the young king. How many men are you going to have? So the compromise was that we think around 2,000 men were used to escort the young king. And by the looks of it, Anthony had no qualms about saying, okay, yep, 2,000 people is enough. So you kind of think, well, if he was involved in any possible Woodville plot that is, you know, possibly people have heard of that was happening at this point, surely he'd be like, no, I need more men than that. So there's lots of, this is like I said, when you start to get, there's a lot of questions raised, and I don't think 100% possibly things can ever be totally answered as to what happened. But they did meet up with Richard Duke of Gloucester en route. They agreed Northampton, as it was on the route to London. And Richard was coming from his lands in the north, which is mostly where he'd stayed out of the way of things as well. So actually, in that respect, he was a similar character to Anthony Woodville as well, as in they weren't necessarily that bothered at that point to be right in the centre of things. But all of a sudden, they you know, they are shoved into it, whether they like it or not, through Edward the Fourth's death. So they meet at Northampton. But it all gets a bit confusing at this point, as the excuse that's apparently given is, well, we can't stay at Northampton, even though it's quite a big town in that period, because it was quite famous for, and it still is, for shoemaking and things like that. So it's quite, you know, a big provincial town. But they say, well, we haven't got enough space to stay in Northampton, which obviously you kind of think, well, you know, it's a big place. I'm sure they've got lots of inns to put people up and things like that. So the story goes that apparently they moved to Stony Stratford, which is actually quite a small place outside of Northampton, which utterly confuses me, if I'm honest, when really the theory that's put forward by Annette Carson, which I think makes a load of sense, is the Woodville's main house of Grafton Regis is actually not that far from Northampton itself. So maybe the possible threat that was seen at this point is they were keeping him safe in Grafton Regis, because this is, you know, it's their own private house. They can keep him safe, and he's sort of on Woodville territory, which might, I can understand why that might look a bit dodgy, if I'm honest, to other people. But actually, Anthony met with Richard Duke of Gloucester himself. He actually stayed in Northampton to meet with Richard Duke of Gloucester. And they met completely on friendly terms. They had dinner, you know, literally like if you were meeting your best mate, although they weren't quite on best mate level, but, you know, at a pub or whatever. They, you know, they actually sat and had dinner together. Perfectly acceptable. There are some sources that claim it, but that Richard Grey, one of Anthony's nephews from Elizabeth Woodville's first marriage, was there as well. But again, all getting on perfectly all right until the morning after. And suddenly, Anthony, Richard Grey, and Thomas Vaughan, who was also in the Ludlow household, they were all suddenly arrested, saying that there was a treasonous plot going off. And what I find personally very telling is that actually the only thing that I can see that changed from that evening, where they were sat down having dinner in the morning, is that the Duke of Buckingham arrived and was having private conversations with Richard, Duke of Gloucester. And the Duke of Buckingham actually did not like the Woodvilles at all. He got quite a lot of beef with them, shall we say, over the, you know, the past few years, because he'd been he'd actually been forced to marry a Woodville, and he said it was below him. So that, you know, there's lots of other things going off as well. And Lord Hastings, who was actually Edward the Fourth's best friend, who was Lord Chamberlain and did all sorts of things with him, with Edward the Fourth, including all his womanizing and everything. He also didn't like the Woodvilles because partly because I assume there was a lot of discussion about his and Edward the Fourth's behaviour. So I think there's a lot of other things going off behind the scenes that possibly this being said, that's being said, is it true, is it not? And it's a time when everybody must be utterly scared as to what's going off. And it's like, who and what do you believe? So there's a lot of that going off. So basically, like I said, those three men, including Anthony, are arrested and they are placed into different places in the north, mainly places connected to Richard, Duke of Gloucester. So Anthony himself is first put up in Sheriff Hutton, and then eventually, but that is in April. It takes until June for them to be decided that they are going to be executed, which again, if they were seriously involved with anything, I'd have thought that they would probably get, you know, head chopped off straight away. So to me, I think really, from what I've seen, that it's more likely that other Woodvilles were involved. And because Anthony was the one that they could get hold of, he was scapegoated for other people's behaviour. Yes, so personally, that's what I think happened. Because like I said, I found no evidence that definitively says he was involved in anything treasonous.
What a horrible downfall to an incredible human being. I was hoping that you weren't going to tell me that they were executed and he was sent off into exile, but you just, yeah, you broke me.
Yes, I think the worst part of it is, so like I said, you know, they take a few months to make that decision. And then, you know, they are actually executed at Pontefract Castle, one after the other, on the 25th of June, 1483. And he actually writes a poem that he's actually written after he's found out he will be executed. And it's basically a poem about how the wheel of fortune continuously turns and not necessarily in the way that you want it to. And I think that actually the way that he's written it is he's not blaming anybody. It's almost like he's completely resigned to that's what's going to happen. And we also know that he definitely did write a will whilst he was incarcerated as well, but obviously as he was executed for treason, we don't know whether any of that was ever abided by either. So there's all sorts of things going off, but his execution is actually famous because he actually died wearing a hair shirt. So that's basically like a really scratchy vest. So kind of like what you think John the Baptist would wear. He was actually executed wearing that. And we don't actually know what happened to their bodies either. There's quite conflicting sources. So most people seem to think that they possibly were buried in a mass grave together. But as far as I know at the moment, no gravesite with the headings has been found anywhere within Pontefract Castle. So again, if that is what's happened, there have been no whereabouts would they have been buried, because it's not necessarily said where. Actually, the weirdest thing is that there is actually evidence that Richard, Duke of Gloucester, paid for a burial for Richard Grey, who was Anthony's nephew, who was executed as well. And that Thomas Vaughan's body, at least a memorial, is up for him in Westminster Abbey, if not his body. So there's all sorts of confusingness, even to the end.
I've got to say, this has been such an enlightening and interesting podcast to talk about. And I really hope people go out and buy your book, because This has been great, and I am sitting on the edge of my seat. And we didn't get through all the questions because there are a
No,
few left.
but yeah.
But people need to go out and buy the book because then they can find out all those unanswered questions that are still lingering above me. Daniel, remind us the name of your book.
Yep, so it's Anthony Woodville's Sophisticate or Schemer. So it kind of does what it says on the tin. It hopefully tries to answer that question. Was he a sophisticate or was he a schemer?
I'm going to go for sophisticate, but I might be a little bit biased right now.
No, because that's kind of what I've come up with, so
Well,
that's
there we
fine.
go. We're on the same wavelength here. It's been really great having you on, though. We'll get this into our bookshop, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.